Good morning, everyone. First, I want to say I do not have any financial relationships to disclose. Just to briefly tell you who I am and about an overview of what we're going to be covering today, with the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey in the School of Public Health and also with Robert Wood Johnson Medical School Department of Addiction Psychiatry, and I'm also the Vice President of NALGAP, the Association for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Addiction Professionals and their allies. There's some other associations that I have up there also, the last being the New Jersey Coalition Against Sexual Assault, where I'm on the Board of Trustees, and I was also appointed to New Jersey Governor's Advisory Committee on Rape Prevention and Education. So what I'm going to be giving you today is an overview of what has been happening in New Jersey as far as changing social norms and policy. It's not a lot of data that I have. Just with the basics of sexual violence, as we understand it in New Jersey, the definition that we use is any form of unwanted, unwelcome, or coerced sexual behavior. What we know from RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, is that a sexual assault occurs every 2 minutes in the United States, and nearly one in every four women may be experienced sexual violence by an intimate partner in her lifetime. The reality is, though, that only 16% of all sexual assaults are reported to law enforcement. In New Jersey, we have broadened the range of our understanding of sexual violence, and we have had changes in our laws, which I'm going to cover in the later part of the presentation, to put sexual violence on a continuum. We do not use the term rape in our legal definition because, in many areas, rape is considered to be penis-vaginal contact, and we know that sexual violence is a much broader term that can be used. But the main thing I want to emphasize is that we talk about any form of sexual violence that is done and perpetrated against an individual without their consent, and also with a person who is unable to give consent. And we define that by someone under the age of 13, under the age of 16 when the assailant is at least 4 years older, and then also with diminished mental capacity, which can mean a victim who is drugged, drunk, high, unconscious, or has a developmental disability. In New Jersey, the Uniform Crime Report from 2004 indicated there were 1,328 sexual assaults which were reported in New Jersey. The Rape Care Centers of New Jersey serviced 4,226 new primary victims and also assisted 1,287 secondary victims during that same year. And what this information is telling us is something that many of us that work in sexual violence and rape prevention and or assistance know, that it's grossly underreported. We see here that there's three times the number indicated in the 2000 report were actually those that were served. And these are just individuals that came in for services. So I just want you to keep that in mind. Currently in New Jersey, we are working on a sexual violence primary prevention program. We were one of six states that were selected by CDC. The first four states received financial assistance. New Jersey received technical assistance to look at and develop what would be considered evidence-informed best practices. It's hard to classify evidence-based when a lot of this has not been, as I said, a lot of it has not been documented, but we are looking at what's considered evidence-informed as far as preventing violence and then also advocacy for rape care survivors. So this is the beginning. We're in just our year one of this particular pilot project. And this is just for those of you who may not be familiar with CDC's primary prevention project. This is just some of the information about it, which is really focusing on coalition building, logic modeling, evidence-based strategies, and ongoing evaluation, which is part of our efforts. So a lot of what I'm doing now is also talking about doing the collaboration with other programs within the state to improve services for LGBT survivors. Just to give you a little data on the consensus of New Jersey, we have seen a sharp increase of households. Now, this is, again, from the 1990 census to the 2000 census, you see an increase in the total number of same-sex partners in New Jersey residing in New Jersey. I don't know necessarily if the numbers have tripled as high as they have, or just in 1990, less people were willing to disclose that they were in a same-sex household. But we do know that currently we do see, and we have experienced, particularly some of the changes in the laws in New Jersey, particularly around civil unions, we have seen a much more expansion of the LGBT communities, and there's always been a large visible communities in New Jersey in certain sections of the state. Just to back up a little bit, because a lot of, as I started to say that we're working with CDC's prevention model, and it's part of the Division on Women of New Jersey, and many of our programs, we have 22 rape care programs in New Jersey. Most of them were started well over 20-something years ago, sometimes up to, I think, the oldest program is over 30 years old now. Most of them were started in women's centers. So integrating the concept of advocating for male survivors of rape has been part of a transition and an ongoing evolving process for some of these programs. But it also, just to speak to the issue of male rape, it could account for about 25 to 30% of child sexual abuse, and an estimated 92,700 men are forcibly raped each year in the United States. And from that accountability, we see that this does not include rapes that occurred in institutionalized settings, particularly prisons, hospitals, and or the military. So they were not measured in the survey. There's some clinical issues that affect LGBT individuals as far as seeking services coming in for assistance following an assault. And that part of what I started to say earlier about a lot of these programs initiated and were originally women's centers. So in those programs, there were some programs that were more adapt at working with lesbian survivors of sexual assault. But working with male survivors for male survivors to even believe that they were eligible for services in these programs, based on just some of the terminology that was used in these programs, it wasn't always a welcoming environment for them. And this is an ongoing process, an issue that we deal with as we're starting to change some of the social norms. For many LGBT individuals who have been assaulted, there's often the fear of a heterosexist response in medical and criminal justice systems. There's the fear of outing oneself. Not only do you have to come out as a survivor or as someone who has been victimized, but also if your sexuality, your sexual identity, or your gender expression is connected to the assault, then you also have to out yourself on that level. And there are many times that many individuals report that they felt uncomfortable discussing that or were unable to access services on the belief that they would not be treated as fairly. There's fear of isolation from the community, and fear of reinforcing negative stereotypes, and there's also the lack of community resources. I also think that there are times in the community, and I speak now to the gay male community, that the issue of rape has been eroticized by some of the population. And I think that has had a lot of damage to the community because they often look at, and there's a misunderstanding of what is consensual S&M activity and what is non-consensual sexual assault. And there are many times that men question the activity they engaged in. If they gave consent to be with someone, to go home with someone, and then it got a little rougher, as they say, they got a little out of hand, it was hard for many men to actually conceptualize that what occurred to them was actual sexual assault or sexual violence because they did not give consent. And that's why, again, we go back to the New Jersey standards and talk about our legal definition. And if someone was impaired or intoxicated, under the influence, given drugs, then definitely they were not able to give consent. The issue of lesbian rape, lesbians are as likely to be raped as heterosexual women, but are also less likely to report the attack or seek services than heterosexual women. And as with gay men, this lack of reporting or willingness to seek assistance can be traced to fear and distrust of the healthcare and the criminal justice system. So this is just some of the reasons why we felt the need to improve services and access to services for LGBT survivors of sexual abuse. The other level of areas that I want to talk about is for the transgender populations, where the complications can be very similar for gay and lesbian sexual violence. But there's also, again, another issue of disclosure, self-blame. For some of the transgender community who work as commercial sex workers, and also the issue of survival sex, which, and I say some of, and it's also, there can be also gay men lesbians, youth, bisexuals who also can work in the commercial sex industry or as commercial sex workers. But we do see there's a disparity in access to healthcare for transgender individuals. There's also a complication which not all providers were aware of, particularly for female to male transsexuals, as far as access to OBGYN care. If a trans man has legally changed his status and his identification to male, then most likely he would be ineligible for any gynecological care that may be necessary. If he does not, if his insurance card lists him as male, then he cannot get treatment for any gynecological problems. So as much as many trans individuals go through their transformation and their transitioning, and we know that this, you know, try not to get off topic here, but there's some implications for some when they go through the legal name change and also their identification change, and there are many times that trans men will keep their health insurance under to have their card still read female so they can access. Now, of course, if someone is victimized, they are eligible for services for victims and witness crime compensation assistance, who would pay for their OBGYN. That's if they come in for services. But the reality is if they don't come in for services, then they're not going to be eligible for that, and they don't have their own health insurance to access with their primary care physician. So often, some of their medical conditions go untreated following an assault. I just want to outline with the New Jersey Coalition Against Sexual Assault, who I work through. We have our member programs, which I said there are 22. That's because we have 21 counties in the state of New Jersey, so each county has a state-funded program. And there's an additional program that was funded at Rutgers University to be part of a statewide initiative. There are other student assistance services available at other colleges, but Rutgers is the only one that's receiving the state funds as actually being a designated rape care advocacy center. So we offer 24-hour helpline, hotline, crisis interventions, information referrals, short-term crisis counseling, advocacy, accompanying to the hospital, police department, and or court, support groups, and emergency clients' needs. My involvement in the rape care programs started about 20 years ago when I was a member of a county sexual assault prevention coalition. And during that time, I continually raised the questions, but what do you do when an LGBT person or a gay man shows up for your services? What's going to happen? And what I heard was a variety of answers. Some programs said, well, we would probably refer them to an outside provider. We might bring them in for services, but then there's going to be some other conflicts. Many times, particularly a lot of the support groups, a lot of the programs facilitate support groups, and there's a question then, how comfortable that individual is going to be coming to a support group. That is, the majority of the participants are heterosexual. And the other complication is then when services are offered to companions or intimate partners of survivors, you have a support group for men whose significant others, female partners, have been sexually violated or raped. And now you have a lesbian who her partner has been violated or raped. What's going to be her comfort level coming to that support group for significant others? And these are some of the problematic issues that we started to address in New Jersey as far as looking at why we needed to integrate our services to be more supportive of LGBT individuals. As I said, we cover the 22 rape care programs. We also offer services in multiple languages. I think we have about 27 different languages that we have translation services available for. We also have a public resource center. Part of NDCOS's task is to do public education and also to expand community outreach. In New Jersey, we utilize a sexual assault response team. And for those of you who are not familiar with the sexual assault response team, I know they're in many different states. There are some states that do not have them, but basically it includes a law enforcement officer, a rape care advocate, a sexual assault nurse examiner. In New Jersey, we are looking to credential our advocates, and the reason why we feel that's important in legal jurisdiction, the nurse, the police officer, and the prosecutor all have a certain level of confidentiality that they maintain, and they often then look at the advocate as not being a full member participating of that team, because that person is not there representing themselves. Even though many advocates are professionals, they're there as a peer advocate, So they are sometimes excluded from some of the exchange of information. So we're looking to credential our rape care advocates, which would also then give them a legal status by the Division of Consumer Affairs. That's just one of the reasons why we're going through advocacy. We're also advocacy training. We're also looking to uniformly unify the training that is provided to each advocate in each of our 22 teams. So back to the LGBT sexual violence, we know that heterosexual homophobia, transphobia in our culture puts LGBT people at greater risk for sexual assault. And it's common for perpetrators to use sexual violence as a way to punish and humiliate someone for being LGBT, and for sexual assault to be one type of violence that occurs during an anti-LGBT battering. There's also the issue of the interpersonal violence that occurs, that not all victims are perpetrated against by someone outside of their intimate relationships, that it can occur within our same partner relationships, with former partners, with other family members, friends, coworkers, and others known to the victim. So the goal was to help providers to understand the difficulty for LGBT victims to receive services, as well as what interventions can be most beneficial. So I developed a training for our rape care advocates based on sexual orientation and gender issues, and I've offered it to several programs around the state and also at a state level. We also offered it to the New Jersey Sexual Assault Nurse Examiners requested the training, which I think was showing some of the improvements within the state. So the training was given to all of the sexual assault nurse examiners statewide. The objectives of the training was to inform students participants of the prevalence and consequences of sexual violence, and also to provide information specifically to working with LGBT survivors. I'm going to have to go through this because I'm getting to the 5 minute, but in preparing a training, part of my role is to talk with the program manager, program director, clinical staff, clinical director, and start putting together a needs assessment. What are their specific needs? What has been their history in the past? Have they provided services to LGBT individuals? What has been their experience, and what has been the reaction to some of the staff as individuals came forward? We then decide what is best to meet their needs. I offer a basic 2.5-hour training, which is adequate for most of the advocates to have a better understanding of LGBT individuals and their issues around sexual violence. But we can also tailor the presentation to expand it to a 6, 8, and 12 hours. And we have done the 12 hours training at our pilot project, which was in Monmouth County, which was 180 Turning Lives Around, where all staff there received full training on LGBT issues. And when I say all staff, we had the clinical training for 6 hours, and then we had additional training for advocates and or support staff, so that anyone coming into the services of that particular agency and whoever they're contacted or in contact with would have a basic understanding or more advanced level understanding of working with LGBT individuals. Just make it a more welcoming environment for the survivors themselves. It was also, I felt, good to give the training on a 2-day process, even if we're using it in a 6-hour training, to divide it into 2 days as opposed to 1 day, because I often find there's a lot of Q&A that occurs among the advocates and among the clinical staff, and they really need time to process the information, and sometimes there are questions that are not asked. So I always use certain strategies as far as writing things down on a piece of paper or see me afterwards, and then we kind of integrate into the training what some of their particular needs are. And as I said, we gave the specialized training to the SANE nurses. And so in addition to the basic training and the psychosocial aspects, we also did include a more detailed explanation around gender reassignment surgery. And there was more sensitive information was shared about the details of anatomy, which is not given in the traditional LGBT program. And that was something that I, you know, made my decision about what I thought was be most pertinent for the sexual assault nurse examiners, since they are giving gynecological exams. Just to wrap up, in New Jersey, part of our efforts are supported by the changes that we've had in our civil rights law. This is a recent publication from the New Jersey Department of Civil Rights on equality and diversity for LGBT individuals, our legal definition for affectional and or sexual orientation, homosexuality, bisexuality. And this is the important piece, I think, for this particular topic, is that now we use the term gender identity or expression, which is a legal protected classification in New Jersey. Having perceived as having a gender-related identity or expression, whether or not stereotypically associated with a person's assigned sex at birth. So definitely any individual transgender or perceived to be of a transgender experience has legal protection in New Jersey when it comes to public accommodations, employment, and public accommodations will include our hospitals, clinics, and healthcare centers. We are also looking at, in New Jersey, PREA, which is the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which was signed into law in 2003, and some of their standards were just released in this past August to look at sexual assault as it occurs. And this kind of ties into the topic also because it's reported and they're now required to show documentation of how many sexual assaults occur in the prison system, which we know a majority of them are same-sex sexual assault. We also have sexual assault perpetrated by staff against inmates, or it could be inmate to inmate, or but this is basically the one of the standards that we're looking at, and in our Rape Prevention Education Committee, we're looking and reviewing that to see how that can be folded into the New Jersey position on prevention. But I believe that because of the already civil rights laws that we have in our state that protect transgender, gay and lesbian individuals and bisexual individuals and or people perceived to be, which also includes for young people an anti-bullying that in our school systems, it's required that a school post their policy on anti-bullying that includes protection for sexual orientation and gender expression. We're done. And just a reminder that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and that's my contact information. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to hold all questions until after all the presentations are done. Our next presenter is Mr. John Bolosnich.
Greetings, early risers.